Thanks very much, Ricky. And I also, on behalf of the Urban Age Project at the London School of Economics, want to thank you for coming. I know most of the people in this room, and I know that all of the ones I know, at least, have attended more conferences than they'd probably like to think about. But I hope the event will remain with you as something special. What I want to talk to you about today is a kind of connection between the past and the present. In my bailiwick, most sociologists of cities have, for good reason, obsessed about the issue of multiculturalism for several generations. That is, how people of different ethnicities, religions, races can live together in the same dense space. I believe that that obsession is something that is going to be displaced in the kinds of cities that we will be seeing develop in the future. The questions of economic inequality and class are going to matter more as questions of difference than matters of race, religion, and ethnicity. And the factual reason for that is quite evident. In a city like Mexico City, that mass of people assembled in Mexico City are mostly Mexican. They share the same religion, they share the same language. What they don't share in any significant way is wealth. And I've reflected on that change between the past and the present in thinking about what it is that the obsessions that sociologists have had with difference constructed in cultural terms might help us, might be of use to us in thinking about differences that are constructed, as I think they will be in these enormously large new cities of the future, in terms of wealth. One way to frame that is to talk about the issue of civility, by which I don't mean good manners, and certainly New Yorkers could, how can I say this, could give the world lessons in how to be in rude. But I mean civility in a more fundamental way, which is the capacity of people who differ to get along together without resort to the institutions of a coercive state. That is, civility means the diversity of urban life becomes a sort of mutual strength rather than a sort of estrangement and civic bitterness. That's an issue, as I say, that's been framed in the past in terms of culture, and now I think it's going to be framed, this issue of civility, in terms of economics. Well, what could we learn from the multicultural past about this economically unequal future of cities? In that regard, I'd like you to consider a history, probably which has personal importance for many people in this room, the history of Jews in the Western cities. Here were a scorned and feared other in European civilization, a people whose urban existence and for whom the question of multiculturalism was key to their survival as a people. And the forms of multiculturalism they knew took three forms, and you'll excuse me for simplifying a very complex history. Forms of multicultural survival, which I think foreshadow the problems of living in difference today, now faced by quite other people, the different people, on a new set of economic terms. You can think about these in terms of three models. The first of these kind of multicultural models that Jews knew as outsiders in cities is encapsulated in the Jewish ghetto of Renaissance Venice. Jews were necessary to the city, not only as merchant traders, but also as doctors and scribes. Doctoring was then dangerous and low-paid work, which Christians avoided. Most merchant traders spoke languages the Venetians themselves did not know, but this skill was also low paid. These necessary strangers lived in a secluded space, the ghetto, which consisted actually of three islands linked together by a set of drawbridges. During the day, the Jews went out and worked in the city. At dusk, they returned to the ghetto islands. The bridges were drawn up. The outsiders shut in for the night, with police boats traveling around the outside of this ghetto. Now, the reason for this arrangement is that Venice lacked civility of a fundamental sort. That is, during Lent, Jews were attacked as the supposed killers of Christ. During times of plague, they were attacked as the supposed poisoners of wells. Prejudices against them were so strong that they could not survive, that they could survive only in isolation with protection from the state. Those patrol boats were meant as much to keep others out as to keep Jews penned up within. So here was a model of urban difference without civility, requiring the state to perform the office of peacekeeping, which civil society could not. And that is one model of multiculturalism. It's a state-based model. To try and understand the second model, skip to Berlin at the end of the 18th century. Jews at that time and place were tolerated in civil society so long as in public they effaced any expression of what made them different. Jews lived throughout Berlin, and though barred from the army and universities, they enjoyed a measure of other legal rights which a Venetian Jew could hardly have imagined. These rights attached to the city's many poor as well as its relatively few rich Jews. But all paid a price. People turned on them whenever they asserted their own particularity in public. In practice, this meant, for instance, that Jews were at liberty to worship within synagogues, but attacked when they built booths or shrines outside the physical building during festivals. Berlin Judaism, in the words of Moses Mendelssohn, one of its most illustrious examples, was the religion of, quote, closed doors and shuttered windows, unquote, not a religion of the streets. So what we have in this second model of multiculturalism is civility exchanged for identity. The exchange, rather like current debates about the chador for Muslim young women in French schools, supposed that civil society and more largely citizenship required its own unitary identities, which eliminated the identities of difference. You could not be different and still belong. As in French schools now, so on the streets of Enlightenment Berlin, the dominant culture became a universal standard for all. So that's a situation in which there is entitlement by virtue of the repression of identity. Now, a third model that we can think of is exemplified by the way Jews lived in cities in London's East End in the early years of the 20th century. These were almost entirely poor Jews. Now, I should say that so accustomed are we to the stereotype of the upwardly mobile Jew that we fail to appreciate how many urban Jews were rooted long-term in poverty. And that was certainly the case for these Jews, clustered around Brick Lane and its environs, the home now to many equally poor Bangladeshis. This was not a protected ghetto, as was Renaissance Venice, nor was it a space of secret identity, as was Jewish life in 18th century Berlin. Rather, it was a space abandoned to its own identity within the larger culture. Leslie Stephen, a reasonably humane late Victorian, said of this Jewish community, quote, they live as they like without being any trouble to us, unquote. The reason for this was that the dominant culture did not much trouble about them. And here lies the secret of the third model of multiculturalism, which is civility based on indifference. The Jews of the East End were free as their forebears were not. Indifference had made them that gift of freedom. But the result of such toleration was mutual ignorance.
The denizens of this unfathomable London, as E.M. Forster called it, did not participate in larger collective life. The Berlin model had repressed identity for the sake of a common citizenship. The London model had repressed urban citizenship for the sake of this peculiar form of multicultural freedom. Now, you'll understand from this very brief overview that if you substitute for the word Jew, the word poor, you'll understand the problem, in my view, that we face in looking at differences in the cities of the future outside of the West. We know that we're in a period of enormous economic growth, and that that economic growth generates inequality, places like New York or London, but magnified many times when we go to places like Mexico City or Sao Paulo. It's something visible to our eye in these enormous shanty towns, these favelas, barrios that stretch endlessly to the horizon. The question is, what kind of relationship do these very, very distended communities have to those who have more power and more wealth? How? And I think my three modules tell us something about this answer. Of the three, the model of the Venetian ghetto, through one of history's ironies, is the way increasingly the rich are trying to protect themselves against the poor. Every time a gated community is built, a new ghetto comes into existence. Every time a prosperous community is ringed by parks or separated by the impenetrable barriers of a highway, a soft ghetto comes into existence to protect those inside. In the course of our discussions in the next few days, we'll need to discuss how effective these modern ghettos are in coping with crime. What I wish to emphasize to you is that, new or old, this form of settlement has given up on civility as a project. It supposes that differences need to be displaced. It is a model of difference which requires a repressive state. The Berlin model, in its own way, is the most idealistic. It supposes that the traces of near poverty, like Jewishness, might somehow be hidden or discounted. Now, lest you think that this is absurd, I'd like to remind you that this was Hannah Arendt's image of a good city, one in which people spoke and dealt with others without reckoning how rich or poor they were those who they addressed. And it's more ambiguously the ideal of Islam's power to unify the city, which animates many Muslim city planners today. That is, a universal culture which discounts material differences. The experience of the Berlin Jews shows the problem here, that universal cultures can be repressive. Universalism can be a smokescreen, in addition, for hiding inequalities as though they don't matter, which in the case of the mass of the poor and near poor in developing cities, they clearly do. So the issue here for us is whether you create a social bind through a notion of a kind of uniformity of civic purpose, an overriding uniformity, which in a way tells a lie about who the people are, who are included in that universal. And this would seem to leave us with the third London model, which is indeed, I'm afraid to say, the future as matters stand now. Dissociation as a version of civility, fragmentation as a form of freedom, a social compromise which works against shared citizenship. A helicopter flight over Cairo, Mexico City, or for that matter, Los Angeles, shows these propositions made into physical reality. Many planning strategies unwittingly lead to this third model dead end, as when we try to decrease density by pushing new development outward rather than gathering it inward within the city, Or again, the London model springs to life whenever we locate public services in the geographic center of a particular community, rather at the edge where that community touches on one of a different character. It's a cliche to say that cities are complex social organisms, but complexity is inert if differences don't interact. So what I am proposing to you is a kind of sociological issue that underlies the kind of specific nuts and bolts discussions we're going to be having in the next few days, is that somehow the notion of an urban society, which is based on dissociation, is this third model of multiculturalism now displaced into the economic realm, is the one that we somehow have, in some ways, got to find an answer to. If the past history of cities is any guide, this model, in a certain way, has the most utility. It's the simplest. You don't see them, they don't see you. You imagine the city works well if they don't give you any trouble. But precisely by creating a city in that form, a city in which diversity and indifference coexist, what we rob ourselves of is a polity. And that, it seems to me, is the challenge that we face in trying to understand what will happen to the social life of cities in the future. Thank you very much.